Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
It's June 12th, 2022. Welcome to episode 0 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now. And my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I like to know. Will I ever find my way back to us?
The RCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, collecting, and overflow. I am Paul Hegstrom, near Boston. I am joined by three retro computing enthusiasts today. The first on my screen is Quinn Dunkey in Los Angeles. How are you?
Hello, I am excellent.
Excellent. Next on my screen is Carrington Vanston in Toronto. How are you?
I'm Quinn minus two.
Excellent.
Which is like the maximum I'm able to achieve.
That's right. I forget it.
And not on my screen at all is Earl Evans in Portland. How are you?
I'm doing well. I'm going to be the narrator today.
Yes. That is only an effect that the people watching the YouTube stream can see, but the Earl is the omniscient narrator voice.
On the podcast, we're all narrators.
That's
because
right.
It's a podcast.
That's true. Okay. Anyway, so we have reached episode 256. We have maxed out all of the 8-bit digits. And we weren't sure quite what to do about that, but we do have Carrington here to carry the carry bit. And so I think we can continue. Anyway, yeah, so I don't think we had a very defined topic. I thought about something. Earl seems to have thought about something. I don't know if anyone else has, but we could start with Earl, our omniscient narrator.
Sure. Well, as I was thinking about going over to episode 0, and I'll note that the RCR never had an episode 0, so this is just correcting an oversight. But I was thinking about, and this is a little philosophical, I'll admit, but the importance of zeros and ones now in our everyday life. If you study early computing, you know that it wasn't a slam dunk that computers were going to be made out of ones and zeros. There were actual decimal-based computers. There were analog computers that operated over a range of values. So eventually coming down to zero and one and being able to use Boolean logic and all of those scientific constructs, I think it is really important for computing, and I think it's important for all of us. First off, I think that the ability to quantize our analog existence into zeros and ones has a lot of impact, and I think it will just grow over time. What I mean by that is we can take our analog existence, and with analog to digital conversion, we can translate it into a stream of ones and zeros. And it's not an exact translation. There's a little bit of loss when you do that. And that's something that phonographic audiophiles will tell you. You know, the ones who have so much investment in phonograph records, they'll tell you that you don't get the warm sound out of a digital file. But what you do get is an audio file that will maintain 100% fidelity forever. Going into the future, this podcast that we're making, I don't know if in 500 years anyone will care about this podcast, but
I won't take that long.
But should they happen to care, they would be able to listen to the podcast exactly as we recorded it today, which I think is awesome. The same thing is true of video. The same thing is beginning to be true of three-dimensional video. And who knows, maybe we'll figure out how to quantize some of the other senses that we have too. But whatever we do, I mean, we could look back at 240p quality video and it looks like a postage stamp. But the interesting thing is that postage stamp is the same quality as when it was made, as day one. And I think that's really important for our historical legacy. And I think it's something that's kind of overlooked because we just have it these days. We just know about it. We use it. But that wasn't true even just a few decades ago. I think another really interesting thing about ones and zeros is going the opposite direction. And this is where retro kind of comes in, because we could take commands that we express digitally and make the computer do something that was analog. For instance, the early demos, the 70s and 80s, we could take computers and make them do graphics. We told them how to do something that our eyes could perceive in analog space. We did it with ones and zeros. MIDI was another interesting example. You could take a MIDI file that you could measure in just, you know, mere kilobytes, and it could conjure an entire orchestra to play you a wonderful, wonderful work of music. And AI is actually starting to be the ultimate expression of synthesis, in that I saw recently on Twitter, you can type in a phrase and there are some AI systems that will then make art based on the phrase that you typed in. Now, sometimes the art is really, really frightening. I don't know if you guys have yeah. seen any of that or not.
It's almost all frightening.
Yes. So it's still way on the other side of the uncanny valley. But I think it's fascinating that with just a few words, I get out of a computer in the cloud an artistic representation of something. And that's just going to get better over time, too. So I think, you know, we don't want to overlook zeros and ones, because those two pesky little on-off states represent so much of our life now, and that's just going to increase over time. And that's what I thought about when we rolled over to episode zero. So, you know, to the world out there, you don't want to be in my head, trust me. But
this, you said you spoke a lot about kind of the eternity of digital, and I think so I have a friend who's a librarian, and they deal with this a lot. People generally assume that once something is digitized and it's data, it's, you know, problem solved as far as archiving goes. But it's interesting talking to her. I came to realize that data is still physical at the end of the day. And, you know, some commenters in the stream there are talking about this as well, that data all has to live somewhere. You know, if it's in the cloud, it's on someone else's hard drive. If it's not, it's on your hard drive. And my librarian friend talked about how basically she was specifically an archival librarian, and they spend all of their time migrating all the stuff that was scanned in the 80s and 90s from format to format, because the drives stop working. Nobody makes zip drives anymore. So they spent a year migrating all their archives off of zip disks onto something else. And then physical hard drive spindles start to go bad. So now they're migrating everything onto SSDs, and then SSDs wear out. And so they're migrating them from drive to drive. So it becomes this sort of constant physical transfer of data. And I just thought that was really interesting, that we think of data as being virtual and eternal and abstract, but at the end of the day, it's still physical. Everything is still physical.
And hopefully there was not like a DVD rewritable step in the middle there, because otherwise everything's lost.
Yeah, there was a whole lot of CDRs in there for a while too, and yeah, those all had to get migrated pretty quickly. Yeah, because that a lot of the stuff is less permanent than we thought it was going to be, right? Everyone thought CD-ROMs were going to be permanent, and even the non-rewritable ones are not. They degrade too, and people are learning that. So the CD-write-onces were supposed to be essentially eternal, and those degrade even faster than the factory-made ones do. So yeah, everything degrades, it turns out. Mm-hmm.
It'd be funny if the archivists were not allowed to skip steps. It's like, no, after iOmega drives, we have to do a jazz drive. Then we'll do like Pocket Zip. Then we'll do SideQuest. Like, hold on.
Gotta go VHS to DVD to Blu-ray.
But I don't want to know every step.
Yeah, and the 5 1/4 inch, you know, floppies are doing pretty well, actually, compared to these things. So
yeah, that's kind of the opposite. We were all told those were going to fail immediately, and most of them are still going. That's sort of funny. They outlived their expected life by quite a bit.
Yeah, I probably periodically mentioned this, but I kind of got into this whole retro computing thing because I read Jason Scott's blog that said, "You blew it, you waited too long. It's all gone now." And I'm still, archiving all these disks now, however many years later that is. Long time.
Joel in the comments says, and yet the Rosetta Stone's letters are still viewable millennia later, chipping things out of rocks turns out to still be the best way. And that reminded me of, my librarian friend. So I asked her, like, hey, so what is the best archival tool? What should we be using? And she said books. Like, books last 1,000 years, and they're still readable as long as they're reasonably well kept and not handled too much. The physical books are still the best way we have to store data. So I just thought that was pretty funny.
Unless it burns down.
Inkjet ink that just evaporates.
Yeah, fire is a bit of a bummer. Yeah. The whole Alexandria thing still smarts. Yeah.
So probably...
Too soon? Are we allowed to joke about Alexandria?
Too soon. So maybe we do want to, like, chisel our favorite, YouTube videos into stone.
Yeah. Better get started now.
Worst flip book ever.
So I guess the ultimate then is to take the ones and zeros and etch those into stone.
Right.
It's a slow process. Exactly.
No, just use big stones and little stones. Just arrange them on the seaside. From space, this spells something dirty.
Even better, it's stone and absence of stone.
Ooh.
Oh, yeah.
It's actually all you really need.
You got to read between the stones.
Yeah.
Exactly. Morse stone.
But then the spacing better be constant, because otherwise you don't really know, like, was that two absences of stones or three?
That's right. Yeah. So we're going to need stone nibbles because we have to start with a stone and we can't have too many non-stones in a row or else the gain gets out of control. Right. Yeah,
what if we have parity stones? I think that would solve it.
There you go.
Yeah.
Oh, the number of people that get these jokes is very small.
Those will be stones written with a little Y instead of an O.
Exactly. Stones.
Yes. Excellent.
Why does anyone listen to this? This is terrible.
I was also thinking about the overflow and just what bytes were and things like that. And I started looking into the 6502 and the carry flag and the overflow and stuff like that. And I realized I don't know to what extent people here are 6502. I guess I do know partly to what extent people here are 6502 programmers, but it turns out I knew how the carry flag worked. I knew how the zero flag worked. I didn't have any idea how the overflow flag worked. And I think I might be starting to understand it. But so that was kind of interesting. And I guess what I would sort of do rather than try to explain it with my weak understanding of it is just to recommend reading about it. Ken Sheriff has a couple of blog posts talking about the 6502 overflow flag explained mathematically. And also he has a separate dive into how it works at the gate level.
Because of course he does.
Yeah, which is pretty excellent. But yeah, I mean, it caused me to realize actually that I was never really trained in computer programming. And so I hear people talk about how, like, in early CS classes, you learn about two's complement and all that stuff. And I only sort of came by two's complement, occasionally and by accident. And so I mostly never paid attention to it. I knew that you could type, -16302, to reach backwards from the end of the Apple II's memory, into the lower area. But I didn't really understand how signed numbers worked. And so I learned a little bit about that. And I gather that the overflow flag is basically kind of like the carry flag, but for signed numbers. Does that sound kind of right to those who actually do know?
Basically, yeah.
So in fact, actually, probably it is the carry flag that's relevant for this episode of the RCR. But at any rate, I now know a little bit about the overflow flag.
And if anyone's not familiar with two's complement, I definitely recommend learning about it because it's actually super clever and very interesting. It's one of those things where, like, yeah, like your first year of computer science or whatever, you learn it and you're like, this is terrible. Like, this is the stupidest possible way to do this. Why on earth does anyone represent numbers this way? And then you learn about all the alternatives and you're like, oh, those are all way worse.
Right,
like,
exactly.
This is the only possible way to do this that doesn't have like two zeros or multiple bit patterns that land on the same number or other like deal killing problems. So mm-hmm. Yeah, two's complement suddenly looks very clever by comparison.
My exact experience where I was like, this is nonsense. That must be why they're telling us to get it out of the way. It's like, oh, this is the best we can do. Okay, I got it.
Yeah. Yep.
Well, so is it not the case that if you actually add a negative number and a positive number, you get a sensible number out?
That's the thing, is it the more you learn about it, the cleverer it gets. Yeah, you can just add bit patterns together with a single algorithm and it works for all signed numbers. It works on both sides of zero. If you're adding two negative numbers, it does the right thing. It does the right thing if you're adding negative and positive numbers that cross back and forth over zero. Like, it always works, and it seems like it shouldn't, but it just does. Mm-hmm. And that's really the magic of it. Yeah.
Excellent. So I learned this call. I learned something about the V flag. And I don't actually know to what extent this carries over to other processors like the Z80 and that sort of thing. But, I would guess that probably even those who don't know the 6502 have come across this kind of thing in an 8-bit processor.
Yeah, the only thing that would vary would be the physical implementation of it. But yeah, everything's 2's complement, of course, and everything will have some sort of implementation of a similar flag for sure.
Yep.
There were some, since this is a retro computing podcast, mm-hmm. there were some earlier computers that were 1's complement. Those did exist and had the issues that 1's complement has, for example, that there are two zeros. Mm-hmm. For anyone who doesn't know, 1's complement is just where you have a sign bit, is that right?
Mm-hmm.
But that turns out to have, that turns out to make basic arithmetic crazy complicated. And then there's two zeros because there's a positive zero and a negative zero.
Yeah, it's the negative zero. Exactly. Yeah. That's my takeaway from 1's complement. It's like, okay, now we got to avoid negative zero. Great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. 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 And in terms of the overflow flag, what's clever about 2's complement also is that when you implement cascading arithmetic through like half adders, the carry bit just kind of falls out naturally. Like, it's the bit that falls out the top flip-flop is your carry bit. And then that, if you're signed, that also becomes your overflow bit. So it just kind of, it all just falls together. It's one of those things where when you look at it in hindsight, it's like, oh yeah, this is the obvious way to do it. But before they had that, you know, the hoops they had to jump through in a 1's complement ALU, for example, to do arithmetic and make sure that the sign bit ended up correct is just madness. And then 2's complement, the hardware is just really, really elegant. So it's sort of inevitable that we landed here, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm glad people smarter than me thought of all of
it. Okay, let's see. Any other thoughts on 256 or 100 or 0 or wherever we are?
On the last show, people mentioned that we were doing all this wrong because there was no show 0. Mm-hmm. But in fact, we've done it the most classical programming way. We've made an off by one error. So of course.
Yeah. Excellent.
That's why Earl's not visible.
Yep.
Exactly.
We are off by one.
It's a three-host show, but oh, there's
Earl. We made an off by Earl error.
Okay, so maybe we can. I'll move to the feedback, I guess, as usual. Some of the feedback was stolen for topics. So thank you, everybody, for sending feedback. It makes this show possible. So Roger wrote on Facebook to suggest that the CS community really should clean up the spelling of its special terms. And so he goes on to recommend Nibble, NYBLE, byte, BYTE, word, WYRD. It not only harmonizes these related special terms, but will also make them easy to do internet searches on. So SEO for our special terms. It also sounds like a pretty CS suggestion.
Yes, exactly. And now there's 13 standards.
Yeah. Exactly. Right.
Last time we talked about there was an eBay auction that had a ZX80, and on it was a ZX81 keyboard. And I hadn't actually noticed it at first, but it, you know, it had the wrong keyboard, and it was sort of at a slight angle. Apparently, this is because many ZX80s were upgraded with a ZX81 ROM. The earlier one had a 4K ROM, the later one had an 8K ROM, but they also gave you an overlay for it. So you could just sort of stick this overlay on top of your ZX81. that, you know, basically, I think because the basic ROM was bigger, it had different functions, and so you want to be able to see the mapping to the keys. The keyboards were functionally different. So what did he say? Andrew, did I say this was Andrew? I don't know. This is Andrew writing on Facebook that's giving us all this information. But the ZX80 membrane keyboards was a single layer that pressed against the PCB, and the ZX81 had a two-layer one, so they weren't just like swappable. But you could put the it over top. So
it was a contemporary upgrade then. It was something that would have been done back in the day.
Yeah. Yeah.
Cool. That's cool. Okay.
So I found some. There's a some ads. You know, if you own a Sinclair ZX80, you can order the upgrade. There's an ad for that, and a picture of the overlay actually going on. So pretty cool.
Wouldn't want to affect that amazing keyboard feel though.
Exactly.
Watch over that.
Yeah,
it would ruin it.
Okay, let's see what else. We have Randy posted on Facebook. So the floppy days 114, Howell Ivey, Exidy Sorcerer, and Exidy. This is an interview with Howell Ivey, who was one of the co-founders of Exidy, who made the Exidy Sorcerer, which we famously do not understand as a podcast. So I thought it was worth bringing this up. But it is, in fact, 1978 computer, Z80, S100 architecture, but doesn't have any slots unless you plug in like an expansion cabinet. And this is the computer that had eight track cassette tape like cases repurposed for cartridges. So
I might not understand it, but at least unlike something like the Sam Coupe, I do acknowledge that it existed.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure this one was real, so that's a good start.
Yeah. Tony wrote in to talk about a Kickstarter called The Gaming Chronicles, and this is I don't know if you have you guys come across this.
No.
Yeah. So this is by the people who did From Bedrooms to Billions, which encompasses, I think, like three different documentaries. So the Amiga years, the PlayStation Revolution, and something else. They're about to do The Rubber Keyed Wonder, 40 years of the ZX Spectrum. But anyway, essentially they went around and did a bunch of interviews for, particularly for the Amiga years, and they couldn't use it all, you know, like they had to make a sensibly sized movie. And so this is essentially a Kickstarter for a serialized, episodic thing that will go into deeper dives on individual stuff that they talked about. And the first one would be about the Amiga 500, which is sort of using all the stuff they had about the Amiga 500 that they collected in the making of the Amiga 1000 thing. Anyway. It looks interesting. It has 27 days to go as we record. It is pretty far along toward its goal. It's got a goal of about 25,000, and it's about 15,000 along.
That goal is oddly specific. Is that typical for Kickstarters? I'm not very familiar with them. 24,632.
Honestly, I looked at that and thought, maybe that's a currency exchange problem.
I was thinking too, maybe it's a currency conversion.
That's probably it, because yeah, they're in London, so that's probably £15,000 or something.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, that's probably.
Yeah, because
right.
If you pledge £15 or more, you can get the digital download. Yeah. So.
Okay. That makes sense.
But it would be kind of cool if it turned out to be like the megahertz rate that the crystal ran at or whatever.
Yeah, or maybe it was just impressively planned out, like they had a detailed budget down to the penny, and this is exactly what they need.
On Thursday, we get pizza, but only Thursday.
Exactly.
We ordered it today in order to lock in the price.
Yeah. No extra cheese. We can't afford it.
Okay, let's see. What else? So I think we talked about something like this before. Andy wrote in over email to talk about the CBM 8032 AV, computer graphics and sound. So what the actual installation is it's a bunch of Commodore, I think, 8032s hooked up to big screens and emitting sounds in a large, auditorium setting. So it's an art project. And, I think they're not doing anything that they weren't able to do in the day, except, you know, for the projection part. Although I think they actually are sending, like Earl was mentioning, you know, sending digital out to analog to create analog signals. I think they are doing some of that, like MIDI control and that kind of thing. But so this is it's an artist whose name is Robert Henke, and this is one of the installations, and there's something happening on Saturday as we record. I don't know what that is, but in Prague, there's, I guess, maybe another instance of this being performed. But anyway, it's a neat idea. You know, he does a lot of digital art, but this particular one seemed like it was topical for us.
I'm pretty sure we talked about either this or him or something.
Yeah,
we definitely have a while ago.
Yeah, the project has been going on. It says 2019 to present, so probably one of the earlier performances we.
Oh yep, RCR 213.
Ah, look at that, Mr. Google.
I am Mr. Google. Oh please, my father was Mr. Google. call me Goo.
excellent. Okay, and then I guess the last bit of feedback that I'll mention here is that. Tony mentioned Earl had been talking about using an ASR33 last time, and Tony wrote to mention remembering the smell of the teletype. The heavy burning machine oil still lingers in my mind, he says.
That's a good point. Yeah.
So I hadn't thought about that in a long time. I remember the sound. I remember the clunk of the keys. I remember the impact nature of the printer, but I hadn't remembered the smell of an ASR33 until I read that. And then I thought, oh yeah, they did have a very mechanical, almost like your car needs a tune-up kind of smell.
I bet it's the kind of thing that if you smelled it, it would immediately come back to you. Like, oh, that's that smell.
Sure.
Yeah, the smell I'm thinking of is typewriters. We talked about typewriters a lot, and they had a mechanical, like light machine oil kind of smell also with, and that it's the same kind of technology as a teletype. So it makes me think of that, and line printers as well, like the big line printers that we used in university, the ones that were in the basement and sounded like machine guns when you went down there to get your printouts. That smell was in the basement of the math building.
All right, I think that'll. Do for feedback. We can move to the items of interest and news. And Carrington, you have the first of these.
Chrome won't let me share.
Ooh, okay. Let's see.
Boot Chrome. So somebody else has to bring it up for those not listening at home. This is a fun one. It's a short one. It's a thing on Reddit. Boo, Reddit, whatever. just that comes out naturally when I say Reddit. But this is really cool. It's a guide to how to use your Apple II as a dumb terminal for your Mac. And the idea is, very, very easily set up your Apple II so it is communicating with your Mac as the Mac's terminal. So just like you'd have the terminal program open, instead it's open on your Apple II. You're typing live to your Mac. Super, super fun and super easy setup. And not only does this person say like how they set it up, then there's a great series of comments below of people say, oh, here's what I did. Here's a thing to add in to make it quicker. And so super fun, and I'm absolutely going to do this. I love the idea that little Apple II to my side. I point as if I had one, but if I did have one, then I was going to try to get it going with my vintage Mac instead. But I like this. I like this idea that I've always got the terminal program open on my Mac. It'd be much more fun if it was a separate keyboard and a separate monitor, and if it was a vintage computer. So I dig it. I dig this a lot.
Just can't wait till you have to, you know, type all those like special characters, like the little braces and stuff.
Braces for chumps.
Might have to, use maybe an Apple IIc or something that at least has most of those characters. It's got pipes and stuff, right? I haven't looked at my IIc
in a while. Got pipes.
Yes. Yes, it does.
My Apple II says, welcome to the gun show.
Cool. Yeah. Okay, let's see. Who's next? Earl is next. Oh, this is cool. Yeah.
This is really fun.
We'll tell you if it's cool.
Okay. Is it cool?
Hold your horses there, buddy.
I think it is. This is also feedback from Tony. There's an effort underway to build a reverse-engineered version of the America Online servers so that we can all AOL again. The details are on a blog entry on livejournal.com. We'll have a link in the show notes. I went ahead and signed up for the Discord that they have where they're giving details about how this works and explaining how you get the client and use it. So I logged in as a guest, and it really did look like the good old days of the 90s being on America Online. And they're writing the back end in Python. And, you know, it must be interesting to try and reverse engineer how the servers and the protocol worked. It reminds me of the efforts that happened a few years ago. You guys probably remember this. Mm-hmm. They were trying to build a compatible back-end server for Quantum Link, which was a Commodore 64 focused, a C64 unique online service. Interestingly, it was the predecessor of AOL.
So, yeah, I was just going to ask about that. Are these at all related projects?
I don't think they're related. I didn't get any sense that the two projects were intersecting in any way other than that they're doing a very similar thing. They're reconstructing a back-end online system so that you can use the client and get on there and remember the good old days. So it was fun.
So this actually uses the real client, like the real from-the-day client?
It sure looked like it. I downloaded it from their Discord, and, you know, I'm always feeling a little sketchy when I download something from a random site and just run it. But, man, it really did look like the AOL client. It had the welcome sound at the beginning.
Did you have mail?
I didn't have mail because I was on a guest account.
Yeah. But can when you imagine so mad at Twitter that you're like, that's it. I'm going to bring back AOL. I'm going to write it from scratch. Yeah.
So it is there a re-implemented modern client that runs on, or they re-implemented the server and you emulate the client on something?
Well, I just ran it on my standard Windows box.
Okay, so it is a re-implementation of the client as well. Okay, that's cool. Did they send it to you on 58 crappy CDs?
I actually joked about that.
And are they still charging your credit card?
I joked about that on our RCR Discord. I said, I want a shiny new DVD to go along with this.
Yeah.
They just keep coming and coming.
I wonder, if this isn't using the real client, I wonder, the way the real client would have worked would be to, like, interact with, you know, some sort of dial-up intermediary, and you might be able to, you know, put something in that in the spot of that, right? You know, so instead of actually dialing up, it interacts some way with, you know, a serial port that communicates with the outside world.
So what I couldn't remember from back in the day, because I actually was a AOL user, and I try not to admit that very often, but I'm trying to remember. If you already had an internet connection, could AOL ride on top of that connection to get to the servers and make its connection, or did it have to be a dial-up scenario? It sure feels like there was a way where if you already had like an ISP or something like that, that you could use AOL on top of that. Maybe somebody who's watching the YouTube stream can remember that.
I have a very vague memory that the answer to that was yes, that when the client came up, if there was already a network connection present, it would just connect. But if there wasn't, then it would figure out where you were and figure out what the local dial-up number was.
Yeah.
But yeah, and Brandon, the client in the chat says that the same. Yeah, I have a very vague memory. I was never an AOL user, but my sister was, and I seem to recall I have a memory of the client coming up and recognizing the connection to the internet was already there and just going straight in and not trying to dial anything. And I also distinctly remember them charging her credit card for 6 months after she canceled.
Very nice. All right. My thing here is also taken from feedback. So Chris wrote on Facebook to talk about the International Research Conference on the History of Computing in the summer of 1976. So the Computer History Museum has, I think this is just recently made this available. It is a collection of sort of restored video recordings of this event, which was basically, you know, 1976, before the computers became personal, right? Looking back at the first 25 years. And, you know, it turns out I don't know a lot of these people because it is they predate my sort of history with this. But it's interesting that these are available and here. There's, you know, one of them, let's see, we have Robert R. Everett talking about Whirlwind. We've talked about Whirlwind several times in the last few episodes here. Let's see, who else? There was how do you pronounce his name? Donald Knuth, probably, talking about early history of programming languages. And so it looks like this would be pretty interesting to look at, you know, and a good sort of a collection of reflections on the thoughts at the time of where they were. There's also a blog post that sort of talks about the contents of this, you know, sort of in a more narrative style, not just a list of videos. And one of the things that it talks about is this was the event where we learned about the what was it called, the Colossus, which was previously hidden behind you know, the National Secrets Act or whatever, the British Official Secrets Act had not permitted any disclosures until just before this conference. And so for the people who were there, this was like a huge highlight that suddenly they learned about a computer that had existed for quite a long time, you know, doing running programs, tasks and things like that. Anyway, not sure this leads to much discussion, but nevertheless, I would encourage people to look at these videos.
Now that they're digitized, we're just going to have to keep migrating them forever from That's one true. Media to yeah. the next. Yeah.
Thanks a lot, CHM.
So we don't get too much feedback. I'm fairly certain it's Don Knuth.
Knuth.
The K is actually pronounced.
I think that's how I've heard it as well.
Yeah. Okay. And I saw a talk in 2011, like over the internet with him. Mm-hmm. And I'm really sure I've always pronounced it Knuth, and I bet you I would have changed that if that was wrong. So that's my memory. And also my first impression of somebody saying we're doing a history of the computer and we're going to host it in 1976 was to think, but computing began in 1977.
Right.
Like I'm so biased towards the first personal computer. I'm like, but there was no history before 1977. So shows you where my head's at.
Yeah. All right. Quentin, you have the next thing.
Oh, do I? You okay. Do. I was insufficiently prepared. So let me just share this tab real quick. And I'm definitely not just talking.
Ooh,
to
I can share tabs. Ooh, I'm so much more professional than Carrington.
Yeah, well, it's a low bar. So this story is one that I just came across recently that I love for all of the overlaps of retro stuff. So this is a blog post by, I'm going to say, Cariad Kiger, and I'm sorry, I'm sure I've butchered her name, but what she has done is ported Doom to AUX, and that is a sentence that not a lot of people will understand, so allow me to elaborate.
Awesome.
Yeah, so as many people probably know, porting Doom to things is kind of a sport, and if it's got a screen, someone has probably ported Doom to it. I have seen Doom running on digital cameras, on refrigerators, on all sorts of, basically if it has a screen, it can probably run Doom. And so it's kind of a fun thing, and it's difficult now to find things to which Doom has not already been ported, but she has managed to find something, and that's AUX. AUX was Apple's brief foray into Unix long, long before they bought Next Step and it became Mac OS X. Apple did have its own Unix variant called AUX that ran on the 68000 Macs. It was, I think, a fork of the IBM RS6000 AIX version of Unix, but it's a System 5 standard. Back before Linux people ruined Unix. Yeah, you heard me. Fight me, nerds. Unix has been ruined by Linux. I've said it before. I'm going to continue saying it. Nevertheless, AUX was actually surprisingly cool. I didn't know a lot about it until I actually read this post. I was sort of vaguely aware of it back in the day, but it's pretty sophisticated. Not only is it a Unix environment that ran on 68,000 Macs, but it actually had a Rosetta-like compatibility environment that would run macOS System 7 apps in parallel in a window alongside AUX, which was then running an X11 server for its own GUI stuff. So it's pretty amusingly sophisticated for the time. And apparently Apple actually supported AUX all the way to 1995, which I also had no idea it was that late. Basically what killed it was the PowerPC migration. They never migrated AUX to PowerPC, so that was basically the end of it. But this is just sort of the story of doing that port. For anyone who doesn't know, Doom was originally written on NextStep, on Next Computers at id, so there's long been original source code for it that runs in a Unix environment. There were some challenges for porting the graphics and so on, of course, because, of course, NextStep was Display PostScript, and this is X11, but the bones of it were there, and they didn't quite get sound working. Sound is always a nightmare on Unix, so that didn't quite happen. But in addition to all the source code being here, there's also live streams of her doing the port, working on the port, and debugging things, which is really cool. That's not something you see a lot of. And I just applaud the effort. In the end, I think the frame rate was something around 2 or 3 FPS, but that's never the point in these exotic Doom ports. It's just fun to see that it works at all. So it's a good read, and I learned a lot about AUX.
Cool. Yeah,
that's
I
very cool.
Don't know very much about it either, but I got an image. I basically have a hard drive for my SE30. I'm gesturing to where my SG30 is, but that starts in it. But so I have typed in AUX before, but I haven't done much with it.
I had a AUX server at work in 1991, maybe 1990, like super early. It was a Quadra that we used for doing production and RIP stuff for big coupon company. So it's my only experience with it, but yeah
that's similar to what she's done here. Actually, she says she has a Quadra and an install of AUX on an SD card just because she's had a passing interest in it, and so that's what she started with. And she goes through the process of installing Mac X, which is an Apple implementation of X11, which I didn't know existed. I thought the OS X implementation was actually Apple's first and only X11, so that's kind of crazy that there was one way back then. And there's some samples here on this live stream of the live stream that she did of debugging it and so on. So it's pretty cool stuff.
Okay, Carrington, you have found Encyclopedia Britannica.
I found a little thing, and I had a question, and I think you've already answered it, because just in a weird Google search, it put me on Encyclopedia Britannica. Hot tip, Encyclopedia Britannica still exists. Way to go, guys. And if you go to their Apple II page, the photo they have as the example of the iconic Apple II that you all know was, of course, bright red. Like, what the heck is this?
Oh, I have questions.
Yeah.
Right? So I was like, why is... And then I see the caption is, image courtesy of Apple Computer Inc. Like, this was the image they supplied? Like, I don't understand. So I have many, many questions. And I believe Paul has found the answer. Is this true? You've got a link to a video.
Yeah. I had definitely. So this picture on Encyclopedia Britannica has been there for a long time. I was actually just now trying to find, you know, a tweet I put, you know, out there about it a while back. But it's like, it's striking. You know, it's a weird. It's the kind of thing that people would look up and why is it red?
Glossy candy apple red. Yes.
Yeah. So there is a video. I found it on YouTube today, called Woz Presents the Apple Historical Museum. And in the description, it suggests that this came from a VHS that was given out at the 2C rollout. So I guess that was, it says 1984, but wasn't that 83? I don't know. Maybe it was 84. Apparently there was a temporary sort of like museum space, Steve Wozniak kind of like walks us through it, sort of pointing out where the Apple One and there's schematics and keyboards and stuff on the wall. Also there are these cases. So there were, you know, he shows the cases, different colors they tried out. There's a blue one in the back and there's this red one, which I think is, you know, the one that Encyclopedia Britannica has a photo of. And you can sort of see off to its side, there's a green one. Yeah.
We like the green.
I would have, I might have liked this red one, you know, but.
I like the blue one. Yeah. The blue one's cool.
Earl, which one do you want? We're all making our choices.
I'm going with the green one also.
Uh-huh. They all turn yellow eventually.
Yep.
That original Britannica entry, can you bring that up again? Because that was really...
It's very red.
I mean, if you... So go back to that top level view. Mm-hmm. I mean, if everyone wondered why Britannica is no longer relevant, this is quite a shocking little screenshot right here. Yeah. So the article is titled Apple II, subtitle Computer. There's an incorrect picture of the topic. Below that, the photo caption is Apple II, subcaption, the Apple II. There is zero information on this, and the photo is incorrect.
Yeah.
And it's surrounded by banner ads.
Yeah.
Lots way to of roll ads. Into the future, Britannica. Really, really nailing this.
Yep. But it's a very, I don't know, bright red.
It really makes like the keyboard look awful. The coloring, keyboard is terrible against that red.
But. It actually looks like it's smooth too. Like the Apple IIs we know have sort of like a rough, you know, they're I don't know what you would call it, but you know they're not smooth.
They got roughened up when they scraped off all the red.
Yeah, I'm sure that's what it was. Yeah. Anyway,
there weren't many red computers, were there? I mean, I'm thinking of the Alice. What other ones were there?
I mean, color was on the way out at that point. So like, it was like beige and white and gray and black were kind of felt like futuristic colors. So I think everybody went
the future is bleak. The future will be beige and gray and black. And
oh, yeah. Curtis mentioned in the chat also, looks like the Alice mutated into Apple II form.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting, too, that Woz presents this Apple Historical Museum because Apple, you know, by the time Steve Jobs comes back, Apple was very much against having Apple museums and looking back and all. It's like, no, that's all nothing. We don't do that. We only see the future and the future is the Newton. Wait, no, the future is not Newton or whatever.
right.
So it's interesting that there was an Apple Historical Museum at all.
Someone in the stream mentioned the iMac. It's easy to forget now, but looking back, that was the striking thing about the first iMac was that there were colors. Mm-hmm. Like that was because we'd had almost 30 years of beige, black, and silver computers. And so the fact that you could buy a blue one was just incredibly shocking. Mm-hmm. And so it's funny to look back at this and be like, oh, no, they had crazy colors that they were thinking about at the time.
In this museum, they also had the Apple IIe was... The 1 millionth, the 1 millionth one they did, the 1 millionth Apple II, which they made gold, and it looks absolutely terrible.
These all look like those hot rodded cars you get together in malls on weekends. They're all the same finishes. They should all have glows underneath them and be jumping up and down in the front.
Yeah. Anyway, okay.
Rob is in the chat. He says his aunt works for Encyclopedia Britannica in Chicago, and I literally could have sent them a photo. Well, then, Rob, this is on you, isn't it?
Yeah. Way to drop
maybe,
the ball.
Maybe, in fact, Rob did send them a photo just as a joke.
Way to go, Rob. Is your aunt's Apple II red?
Okay. Anyway, I think that was all of the items of interest or news. And so now I guess we are ready for a word from our sponsor.
Why is America on America Online?
It puts the whole internet right at my fingertips.
You can send instant messages just like that.
The news is breaking. I've got it now.
I can stay a little closer to my family.
You've got mail.
America Online. Easy to use. Friendly menus.
Put in the disc, click, you're online.
And we've been working night and day to more than double capacity and make it even easier.
I got homework help, and my dad thinks I'm a genius.
America Online. So easy to use. No wonder it's number one.
And we're back. Okay, so the host's retro computing gift idea that I found, it is a poster, MOS 6502 poster. This is basically the image that was created from the Visual 6502. So they, you know, that this is a project that sort of analyzed the 6502, and there's even like a emulator you can run that will show you all the sort of connections being made and whatever. And this is now made into a poster and looks very nice. You know, I think the person making the poster is just, you know, someone who took the image and made it into a poster. I don't think they had any connection with the project, but I think the project allows for that. Looks nice. $8. So, no, actually, that's shipping. How much does it actually cost?
I see it as $20 plus $8 shipping for me.
It is being sold on a site called eCreator, and I don't know anything about eCreator. Does anyone here know anything about eCreator?
I've never heard of this site.
Having said that, I think I bought some disk drives on eCreator a long time ago.
Is it an auction site or like a classified site?
I had assumed that it was something like Etsy. And I think in this case, it actually is. I think there are more than 10 available. You can buy them for $20, but $8 shipping. But I think it is actually a sort of more general Craigslist, eBay-like site. Because I remember actually I was quite anxious about buying these disk drives from eCreator because it seemed sketchy.
It does look a little sketchy, yeah.
But anyway, the disk drives did arrive, so hopefully this poster will too. But it looks nice. I could imagine putting this up. It looks sort of like a, you know, sort of, what do you call those things that you hang on your wall?
Tapestry?
That's it.
Tapestry.
Okay. Anyway, So
if you click on the link to bring the image full screen, see mm-hmm. something I've always thought was interesting once I saw this. At the very top there, like mm-hmm. right at the top of the screen, see, it looks like there's words there. And every time I see this, I think, if I could just figure it, fuzz my eyes the right way, this is going to mm-hmm. say something. The circuitry always looks to me like it says the word friendly. Oh, maybe I'm just... Maybe it just talks to me.
In this top area.
But yeah, in this top section. Doesn't that look like there's... It's almost words.
Yeah.
It does.
So, yeah. It's my impression. Every time I look at this chip, I think, it's just... If I could squint, I could see what the chip is trying to say to me.
Or maybe it's like it's wrapping at the wrong column or something like that. So if you could
something
just
like
shift
that.
It just a little.
Yeah.
Didn't we... I think there was that episode of Chicken Missile where the game was something like that. We had to try to figure out exactly how wide the thing was before it wrapped. I don't know. Anyway, it doesn't matter. The poster looks cool. It looks like tapestry.
Like a tapestry.
Actually, there should be a tapestry. That would be a terrible, terrible project if someone wants to weave this.
Melissa Barron would do it.
I was going to say, Melissa Barron, who brought her incredible digital weaver machines artwork to KFest one year. She had screenshots of Oregon Trail and so on all done on a digital loom. Mm-hmm. And they were absolutely amazing, and they were sold out quickly and then gone forever because she no longer has access to the very expensive digital loom at her art school, is my understanding. But if she ever finds a way to make them again, I'm sure they would sell out again because they were incredible.
Yep. She's very cool glitch art and stuff. Yeah, she's awesome.
Excellent. I think she has a site that you can get these things from. So we'll put a link to that in the show notes. Okay, so once you're done buying tapestries and glitch art, we can turn our attention to eBay. And Carrington has the first of the auctions we will talk about.
I do, that Paul will share for me, I hope. First thing is a weird choice that I'm trying to sell Paul this time. Imagine your computer, you got a vintage computer, but it just isn't fun enough to look at. So the first choice is Screenies. So this is... computer screen. It's a frame. So it's a frame you put in front of your computer to make it look like a space station. Does that look like a space station to you? I don't know. But it's 2124, according to the US here. It's got 3 days left, so lots of time to buy this, Paul. And I think it would dress up any of your vintage computers. I don't understand how you can use a computer without this. I'd also like to see what the rest of the series was. But this is the space station theme. Fits who knows what size screen. I don't know. It can be anything. You can't tell from this. But it sticks onto your front of your monitor and gives it a much more interesting look around the edge. So that was my first choice for Paul to purchase.
Is weird.
Yep.
Carrington, you always find this stuff that's like schlocky gift shop stuff from the 90s that like your grandma would buy for you.
Hey, don't make fun of my grandma. Yeah. You bought me these great things. So my second choice
for the bezel enthusiast in your life.
If this makes your monitor a little too rough to look at and mess up your eyes. You can make your eyes feel better, apparently, by hanging on the side of your monitor, the monitor mobile. So another glorious item from the 90s. This sticks to the side of your monitor and then has a hanging mobile kind of in the feel of 19. I don't know. I don't know what this is supposed to. I don't even know how to describe this, but it's like a baby mobile, but it hangs from the side of your monitor and supposedly, according to the text in this thing, can help with eye strain. How that helps with eye strain, I guess, because you look away from the monitor and you look at the little. It's great. So this Paul needs both of these items, your life has been empty without them. Yes. Just loving this thing. So it's like the Memphis group. That's, I guess, what I was thinking. So it's a Memphis design style thing hanging from your monitor. It's in glorious plastic. And
oh, you're right. It is.
Yeah.
Interesting.
So perfect. Perfect for your 1990s computer. Stick this on the side of it. So those are my two things that Paul should buy. The third thing is something I just had questions about. So it is this Shazam System Reference Manual from 1965, apparently from the Defense Atomic Support Agency. What the heck was this Shazam computer? I tried to look it up, and I found a bunch of things about an economics computer called Shazam, but that started in 1977, like all computing history did. So what is the Shazam computer from 1965? And this is the monitor or the manual for it. Reference manual apparently takes some form of punch card or some sort of computer card anyway.
It describes what goes in what column.
Have any of you heard of this thing? What is the Shazam computer?
I have not.
I've never heard of it.
Nope, me neither. Couldn't find any references online about it as well. Google Shazam computer, you can find the Shazam, you know, the music software that exists now, and this economic stats thing that was big in the 70s and 80s and up to 2000s that ran on Windows. But what is the one from 1965 that is apparently a defense computer of some sort? Never heard of this thing. And there's a manual.
Does it say Melonix?
Yep, tried finding that company and found it's a division of some other company, but can't find any reference to this Shazam thing. What the heck is this Shazam computer from the 1960s or 50s or whatever? Can't find any reference online at all. So I was hoping one of you knew, or maybe a reference, or maybe a listener.
That cover is amazing.
Yeah.
Like, it looks like a prop from Fallout. Like, it's got that 60s, like, the future is great,
fact,
but maybe we're
be,
also all dead kind of look.
This could be a prop. Like, this could be from a computer or from a computer game, and it's not actually from 1965. But apparently this is
funny.
From 1965. Yeah.
Excellent.
There's mention in there of CDC 3600. I wonder if this is actually a control data computer systems, whatever, that was actually just rebranded or repurposed by Atomic Energy Commission or something.
Okay.
And then this was like a local reskinned manual for a specific application or something.
Could be.
Yep.
I think that was a thing. Like vertical, like government agencies and so on would buy the hardware from, you know, one of these producers, but then like produce their own manuals and so on because the machines were customized for their application, whether it was census data or whatever scientific application. So they would produce their own manuals and so on for that particular use case of it.
Well, either that or maybe this is the thing that became the Sam Coupe.
Yes, Sam Coupe mainframe.
Yeah.
So it's another copy of this same book on Abbey Books right now for $35. So I found that. And it's the same one with the two up in the top corner. So I don't know if it's the same one that's dumped on eBay or just – I don't know. The whole thing confuses me.
Probably literally the same book then,
Yeah.
I betcha.
Mystery computer.
All right, Errol, you have the next one.
And since I'm still in narrator mode, could you bring it up, Paul?
It is up. Can you see it?
I can. This is an Osborne 1, and I like this auction for a couple of reasons. One is, it looks like it's in reasonably good condition and comes with some of the software. And the second reason is, the person actually tested it and says that it works, and you can see pictures of it working. You can see software loaded up and running on it.
Little tiny monitor.
These are so ridiculously useless.
Yes, that little CRT is tiny. And
it actually does look like it's in good shape, though.
It does. These machines are still popular with collectors, and I thought that the initial bid price of $100 wasn't bad either. So the shipping wasn't even horrible. The shipping was showing as, I think, $77 to me or something like that.
2350 even. So I guess it's coming from New York, so it's going a little less far to get to me.
But yeah, still, that's so cheap. I would be worried about how it's going to get packaged. Mm-hmm.
You definitely would want to package this carefully, even though it's initially intended as a travel computer. Mm-hmm. Still, they've gotten kind of brittle over the years, from what I understand. So hopefully it arrives in its new home without being much worse for wear. But I really enjoyed this auction. It was kind of refreshing after all the dregs I have to put myself through on eBay finding something good. This was a nice little diamond in the rough.
Yeah, it's nice to see proof of life, like actually running software in the photos. I like that photo a lot where all the floppies are piled into the storage area. I always wonder, was that safe? Because it's awfully close to the CRT, right? And CRTs have magnetic fields, but I don't, is that okay?
Yeah, I was actually going
to ask. This
is
making me uncomfortable, this photo.
Is that what they were for? Maybe that is what they were supposed to be for.
I assume that's what they're for, but still, I'm worried for these floppies.
I mean, they are perpendicular to the CRT, which might help. I'm also realizing that my CRT is just terribly Spartan after seeing all of Carrington's CRT bling. I have to go out and buy that now because my CRT is so barren.
I'm all about the bling, obviously.
Did those bezel decorations come in tiny versions for the Osborne?
Yeah, I hope so.
Just kind of holding an actual stamp. Mm-hmm. Stick it over there.
Somewhere, I think every time these come up, I am reminded of the fact that you could get a sort of Brazil-style, Fresnel lens thing to increase the size of this miniature screen.
Every time I see these, I think about the movie Brazil. Totally. Yeah. Yeah. If it wasn't Brazil, I just think the only way to work with these is one of those big screens.
Yeah.
They made those for Game Boys as well and other handheld consoles. They've all had little ridiculous magnifier attachments that, yeah.
Am I next? I think I am next. The first one I was going to talk about...
Oh, Microprofessor.
Seems to already have been sold. But I'll talk about it anyway. Because by the time this actually gets edited and put on the screen, it would have been sold anyway. But this is a Microprofessor 2. So we were talking, I think maybe last time before, about the Microprofessor 1 series, which was this little like a Z80 board in a book-shaped clamshell case. This is the Microprofessor 2, which is same company, now an Apple II clone. And it's a funny little thing. It looks, to my eye, it looks like a modem. It's mm-hmm. like a little flat box. It has a keypad on top. And it's a self-contained, Apple II, cheap Apple II clone, which is not quite compatible because, for one thing, it doesn't have a text mode. Its text is all rendered in high-res graphics, and so the memory map is all goofy.
Why?
Why
would you do that?
Because I think partially it has... my guess is that it has partially to do with the fact that it is a Chinese computer, and they had a... There's actually sort of a second layer that you can get that I've never seen, but except in the manuals. But that basically provided you with a Chinese character set. Text mode is pointless for that. And it's an interesting thing. There was a Brazilian computer that I'm forgetting, it's like the TK6000 or something like that, TK2000 maybe, that was a clone of this.
If you get rid of the text mode and you mess with the memory map that much, this becomes completely not a compatible. Like, what could you... Nothing would run on this. So why even make it an Apple II? Why start as a clone? Just make a computer.
Yeah.
Quinn will tell you, making computers easy. It takes like 5 minutes.
Yeah.
She knocked it out over the weekend. Easy. That's a big power supply.
That I wonder how compatible it really is. That's pretty interesting.
There are instructions.
Oh, there's a title.
Yeah.
That headline has not aged well.
No. And even this one seems to come with a photocopy of the manual.
And it shows the computer in bright candy red.
I think basic programs might work, you know, if you were just typing them in. And there are instructions, you know, as to how you can convert things. And I think I forget exactly what the that I do. So I do have a lot of pieces of this. I have the microprocessor 2 unit and the power supply and a disk drive attachment and something else. Oh, there's a keyboard actually too. You don't have to use the keyboard on the thing. There's a keyboard that you can plug in that's actually sort of separate. And I haven't played with it very much, but that's definitely something I want to do because the documentation is actually pretty thin. Like there's not much on how you do stuff with this, and it isn't quite compatible. Like with, you know, the memory map not quite being the same. So I'm interested to write programs for me and all four other people on the planet who could also run those programs. But anyway, so it's sold. I don't know for what. It looks like it was listed at $300 and then disappeared. So, but it is quite rare. I mean, like I was lucky to have found the one that I found.
The name of this company is delightfully dystopian. It's a multi-tech industrial corporation.
Yeah. And I think that's the same multi-tech that did later make modems in this shape. So, and I think we determined before they became Acer after that. So it is a company that still exists, but, okay. I don't know if you also had this experience, but, the eBay auctions to pick from were pretty thin this week. I don't know what's happening with eBay, but no one's selling the good stuff anymore.
Hey, what are you talking about?
You say mine weren't good? Monitor?
Well,
speak. Come on, Paul.
I did not come across yours somehow. I don't know.
Exactly. I bring the goods.
Yeah.
Do you?
Oh, I do. Do you?
This is just a couple of Cray catalogs, and I was mainly just liking, you know, the Cray design. I think the Cray computers were just really quite elegant.
Yep,
they really are.
So
yeah,
this is the one you have on screen. Is actually that was my favorite because the padded vinyl seats were the power supplies for each unit. So in under the cushion of each of those seats is a power supply for that column of CPU, basically.
I never knew that. That's cool.
I worked at SGI at the very tail end of Cray, basically. So Cray got bought by SGI, and so there was a little bit of an overlap where our field techs were servicing these machines. And so though I never got to go see one, but they had stories. So Cray would do a lot of things to sort of justify the $20 million that, you know, you've just charged the government for this thing. Mm-hmm. And so they would do things like the liquid cooled machines. They would plumb the cooling lines out of the machine and back in, and they had air injected into them so that there'd be like neon colored bubbles running through tubes that you could see. And so when you looked at it, it would be like, wow, that looks really high tech and therefore definitely worth $20 million. And, but then those machines, you had to drain the coolant out of them for any kind of service. So the technicians would tell stories of, you know, when you go to upgrade the RAM on a certain model of Cray, you have to bring a pail because you have to drain the coolant out of it before you can open the case and things like that. So, yeah, they were very funny machines for a lot of reasons.
Cool. Yeah, and the other thing, actually, that this when I see them, it reminds me of a recognizer. Somehow, it has a very Tron look to it.
Yeah, for sure.
And actually, that reminds me, since Rob is actually in our chat, I was just listened to the You Don't Know Flack episode on Tron, because I am very far behind. That
you
was
are
the,
far behind.
September 25th, 2020 episode. But anyway, it was fun to hear. So I would recommend listening to that and all the other episodes. Next one. This is Novation AppleCat 2 modem, etc. It says I think we have talked about this before, right? The AppleCat. We probably talk about it every fifth episode.
Well, you do anyway.
Yeah. Okay. So this is it's a set. It has a blue modem card that says Novation on it. It has a handset. It has a little box with some ports on it, and it has an acoustic modem. And so This has been put together by somebody who doesn't really know what this stuff is. I don't know the story behind it, but some of this stuff, it's all of a certain amount of rare. The blue card goes into the Apple II, and that's the primary AppleCAD II modem. And that's interesting for reasons that we will have talked about in other episodes. But one of the things that was special about it is it could do 1200 baud at half duplex. So there was a whole sort of pirate scene based around this 202 capability, Bell 202, 1200 baud half duplex. But the other thing it could do is it could connect to things like a BSR, is that what it's called? System where you can like control control things through the power lines of your house. X10. Yeah. So, and the little box that's in this auction is actually an interface to that. So if you, I think there's an extra thing you could plug in here to connect to the X10 system and turn lamps on and off. There's it also has a connection for like a serial out, I think RS-232 out, and a couple of other things. This box, the box is super rare. The modem itself is kind of rare, but not super rare. And in fact, you can
see... I haven't seen the box before. I've never encountered
that. Yeah, me neither. I've never seen one.
Yeah, it's a... not many people bought them, I guess. But however, the person who provided the Apple II in National Lampoon's Vacation did have one, because you can see that box in the Apple II in National Lampoon's Vacation.
Good spot, Keith.
But
you are a hardcore fan of the AppleCAD.
Right. Wow.
Anyway, also this acoustic modem, it is a Novation modem, and Novation provided that acoustic modem to, like, you could buy it as it's called the Novation Cat. You know, you could buy it as a standalone acoustic modem. Actually, I think Radio Shack also had a branded version of this. And Apple very briefly had a branded version of this, and this is that Apple branded version. So this is also hyper rare.
Yeah, I've never seen this either.
Nope.
Wow.
I mean, it's hyper rare only in the sense that it's got, you know, like an Apple produced sticker on it.
Right.
You know, I mean, like, Apple really did sell it. You can find it in their catalog. It was, I think, called the Modem 2B.
Or not.
Yeah. And then it also had a handset that the handset goes with the AppleCAD. You could answer the phone with your AppleCAD. And in fact, actually, there's a did I show these before? I think I might have. But there's these little things that you can hang on the side of your Apple II. Like the Apple II had little vents.
Put the handset on it.
The cradle.
Yeah, and there's a very funny promotional picture of an Apple II, you know, with the thing, you know, hanging in the vents. And I have a remake of the thing that you hang in the vent. So you... there's two of them. James Littlejohn made these. I'm intending at some point to hang this in the vent of my Apple II.
As one should.
Yeah.
This photo just makes me think that it's kind of neat. There was this beautiful moment in time where telephone handsets all across the United States and Canada were sufficiently standardized mm-hmm. that you could create a product like this. Like, there was this moment, was it 15 years or something, where all handsets were identical, and so you could make a rubber cup device that is guaranteed to fit your phone. Like, we had these phones in our house growing up in the 80s. Mm-hmm. Everybody had them, I guess, because we all had to rent them from the phone company.
Right.
It was terrible, but still, I think it's that kind of standardization is neat and long gone.
Yeah, it's your iPhone is not going to do anything with this thing.
Yeah.
Well, you say that, but I think you actually can get a standard sized handset coupler that connects via Bluetooth to something like your iPhone. I'm not sure how much it would like modem signals, because all that A to D and D to A converting going back and forth probably handle 300 baud just fine.
That would be very funny to try. I would love to try that. Here it is. National Lampoon's Vacation shot of the Apple II. You can see the AppleCAD box on the back.
Yeah, I remember the scene from the movie, but I never would have noticed that.
Nope.
Wow.
Yeah. Excellent. Anyway, so this the Novation auction, I think it just was listed today. It has 6 days, 21 hours to go.
So $10 seems a pretty good price.
Yeah. If
that's insane. There's no way this is going to go for that low, right?
Yeah. Well, unless nobody notices. But yeah. I mean, I think even just the common blue Apple Cat 2 card would go for a fair amount. But if anyone knows what this other stuff is, then it will go for a lot.
I kind of want to buy that myself, because even though I wouldn't use it, but just because of how rare all that stuff is and how it seems to be priced like nothing.
Yeah. Well, at the very least, it's a fair auction. Like, you know, this we can kind of believe will go for
there's 6 days left. It's probably someone's going to find this and drive it up, I imagine.
That was probably the best of the auctions I had. Should I keep going? I don't know. So next one I had is it's an Elf 2. Does anyone know the Elf 2? It is the predecessor to the Cosmic Elf.
Like I say, I think we talked about this ages and ages ago on something. Yeah, I think.
When I say predecessor, I meant successor, of course.
Successor, right.
The Cosmic Elf was a kit-built computer that's based on the RCA 1802. And the Elf 2, I think, was a marketed, you know, sort of improvement of that. And I don't know very much about it. You can get there was a popular like build it yourself kit. What was that called? Earl, maybe you know. It's like the business card or something like that.
I think I know the one you're talking about. It was a Cosmic Elf that fit in an Altoids tin.
Yeah.
Or something like that. Right?
Membership card.
That's what it was called. That's right.
Yeah.
Well done.
Well, thank you, Google. But
that's Mr. Google to you.
Okay.
Call me Goo.
That's good. Yeah, we've wrapped around now.
Yeah, full circle.
Okay. Anyway, so if you were interested in getting, you know, I mean, probably in about as good shape as any Elf 2 that you can find today. This is actually, I don't know. Okay, yeah, I guess it looks like it's kind of like a backplane and then a card that goes into it, I guess.
Are the things on either side are like blank circuit boards for you to build with? Is that what those are? Easy circuit things?
Yeah, it looks like that must be what they are.
Did you say, is this still built around the RCA 1802?
Yes, I believe it is. That's what Wikipedia was telling me.
One thing I noticed from the ad is that this thing has pixel addressable bitmap graphics, which for 1978 is bananas. Like, that would have been extremely rare. I glanced at it while on the way by. It looks like it was, because it only has 256 bytes of RAM, so there's no frame buffer. So this is an interrupt-driven chasing the beam kind of situation. But
yeah,
this thing called the CDP-1861 Pixie graphics chip. I'd like to know more about that thing. Unfortunately, the link is red there, indicating there's no more information about it. But that's very, very early for a pixel addressable graphics system of any kind. So that's pretty cool.
Neat.
It's probably along the lines of the Atari 2600, like a single register that you could flip to chase the beam or something. Neat.
Yeah, it looks like it was a $20 chip in 1977.
Yeah.
I'm now reading about it.
I think this has already gone up quite a lot since I put it in the show notes. It is now currently at $159, basically, seven bids in, 2.5 days left. And actually, so the person who listed this then found some more parts. So has some extra parts to accompany, you know, the other eBay auction. So, which it seems a little lame, I have to say.
Yeah. So
if you want the power supply, you have to go in on the
bid
second
separately
one.
For it.
Or if you lose the first auction, you want to screw over the person who beat you. You're like, oh yeah, well, I'm taking your power supply.
Then what if you win this auction and lose the other one?
Yeah, exactly. You also could, if you want, get a Radio Shack answering machine thrown in, because it happened to be in the same box.
I remember these. I think we may have had one of these at one point, the Radio Shack Duophone. Yeah, I remember that thing.
Excellent. Well, I suppose you could bid on just this auction. I only want the Duophone.
Yeah, keep the power supply.
Ah, okay. I'll talk about this one. This also comes up regularly, but now there's an auction with a picture of it. This is the ZX Spectrum expansion system that includes the microdrive, and the microdrive is the sort of wafer tape, you know, continuous loop drive. So I thought it was kind of interesting. I actually also thought it was kind of interesting that it says, you know, it has a ZX interface 1 for a local area network and RS-232 interface. And when I read local area network, I think of that as a term that postdates this. But it is, in fact, it's not like a new thing. It is like an old thing, even though it looks like it could be a new thing. I mean, like it's in
really good shape, yeah. Except mm-hmm. for the box being trashed. But
yeah. And when I looked at it, I thought, oh, well, maybe that's where you put your SD card. But no, in fact, it is for the little wafer tape thing.
I actually didn't know that these drives existed for any other machines. Like, these were the Sinclair QL drives, the tape loop wafer. What did they call them? The microdrive? Yeah, microdrive. Yeah. But it was actually, that's right, they didn't use the word disk, but they wanted you to think it was like a disk drive, mm-hmm. but it was actually a tape loop. But yeah, I didn't know they existed for anything besides the Sinclair QL.
And they're little too. There's a photo of it next to a cassette here, and it's a quarter of the width of a cassette. And actually, you know, this is a picture of an opened one, so you can sort of see the tape looping. And the fact that the human brain sees anything with these kind of characteristics as a face.
Pareidolia.
Makes it look like a very sort of surprised tape loop.
Yeah. Why so shocked, microdrive?
I can't believe I'm on a disk drive. What?
Yeah, what's going on, buddy?
They promised me.
His expression says, oh my God, I'm terrible. That was a marketing gimmick.
Anyway. Okay. So, yeah, that's the, okay. Yeah. So this whole thing, has, it's ending within a day. It has 18 bids and is at $55 at the moment. So, all right, that's it for me.
Cool.
What's next? Closing discussions. So we turn to closing notes. Carrington, you have the first of these.
Do I?
And it is a Kickstarter.
Oh, yes, my girlfriend, who's totally real but lives in Canada. That's why you don't know her. Yeah, she's it's not a ritual thing, but she's helping launch a new company. She left her last company, and they're trying to do these environmentally friendly cleaning products, I don't know, that support youth health and mental health. And they're doing a Kickstarter starting Tuesday. And so I was bugging some friends of mine to say, like, hey, go help her Kickstarter. They need to raise like all of $5,000 for the tooling or something small. And of course, all my friends being my friends said, yeah, well, what do you give me if I do? I'm like, buy a sponge, man. Like, support my girlfriend. Like, come on, buy a sponge. So I had promised them that if it gets funded on the first day, I will bring back 1 megahertz. They helped my – so now if this Kickstarter gets funded, I'm bringing back a podcast. All right. Which has nothing to do with this Kickstarter, but apparently I will be bringing back 1 megahertz. So that's why I brought it in, because that's happening in my retro computer world. I'm apparently bringing back a podcast. So
excellent,
but only if it gets funded on Tuesday.
I was a big fan of 1 megahertz, so I'm rooting for this now.
Yeah.
Well, then buy a sponge. Buy a sponge on Tuesday, because if they get funded on the first day, then I have promised to bring back the podcast. So.
Yeah. Do we say it now that your podcast is sponge worthy?
Yes.
Ah, wow.
Wow.
I understood that reference.
I did as well.
Well,
weirdly,
little 90s Seinfeld deep cut there for anyone who's wondering what the heck's going on right now.
So if you want me to bring back a 1 megahertz Apple II podcast, then yes, go buy a sponge on Tuesday.
So is the 1 megahertz hiatus now retro?
Well, kind of. I mean, it's been an underground podcast for a bunch of years now. Like, there are like ways to get it. It has actually been a continuing thing for ages, but it's sort of secret. So, but it will come back as a public podcast. So,
excellent.
Yeah. Rob says he's in for $5,000 worth of sponges. I think one sponge will be sufficient.
Maybe he's got a lot of cleaning to do. You don't know.
Maybe a lot of cleaning.
Excellent.
This episode will come out after the Kickstarter is over. So if you're listening, too bad for you. If you have if the podcast has come back, it's got nothing to do with you. The only people who follow me on Twitter would have gotten the link. So.
And if it didn't, well, thanks for nothing, listeners. Jeez.
Exactly, because then no podcast for you. It stays invisible.
All right. Earl, any closing notes?
Yeah, just a quick one. I've made this observation before, but as you get older, it becomes less and less fun to lift heavy things, I've noticed. Not that it was ever like super fun to begin with, but it's less fun now. So we were cleaning out the garage and I wasn't having a lot of fun. But what I did have fun with was my Altair desk was out there. So when I got that bunch of Altair equipment, one of the things that I got was an Altair desk. And they're not that common, but in the Pertec days, after Pertec bought MITS, they came out with a business system that had an Altair turnkey, and it had some disk drives, and it all fit into this really super, and this is, if you're living in the 1970s, attractive desk with fake wood grain, and there's a giant blue 19-inch rack mount cabinet that attaches to the desk, and it's Altair blue, and it's where you would rack mount the Altair equipment and the drives and stuff. It's incredibly heavy. So the Altair was heavy, the dual 8-inch drive unit is heavy, the desk is heavy. So all of this is very heavy.
Why is everything in the future so heavy? Is there a problem with gravity?
Yes.
So I may collapse into a crater at some point when my floor gives way and says, no, that's enough. I've had it. But it was fun to put it all together, though, and get it cleaned out. It had decades worth of dust bunnies and other little, you know, long-expired friends living in there. And so I got out the gloves and the mask. I literally was wearing a mask, putting it all together. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I guess one of the strange, somewhat helpful side effects of being in a worldwide pandemic is that you've always got a mask handy. So
yeah, we all own those
I
now.
I have so many masks.
So, and it actually looks pretty nice down here and takes up less room than the desk that it replaced. So I'm kind of happy.
That's really cool. I love old computer desks and things with the computers had to be built into and stuff, and recessed areas for computers. Love all that stuff.
Yeah, I loved it when a desk was an option that you could get for your computer.
Mm-hmm.
Now, back in the Open Apple days, Em and I talked to Nooney. What's her name?
Oh my gosh.
Lane Nooney, thank you.
That was one of my favorite episodes because I followed her on Twitter ever since then. Yeah,
just the domestic impact of home computing and like printer stands became a thing and like all this furniture had to be invented for these things that nobody thought of, and people had to figure out what room the computer goes in.
That's
because
the
now
thing
it's
that blew
furniture.
Me away. Right. That she talked about that. I never even thought about it before. Like where does the computer go? And it's a living room thing or it's about like
is it an appliance? Is it a TV? Is it like what is
amazing.
This thing? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I love that stuff.
And if it's red, you know, what does it match?
Exactly. Is it going to alarm the dog? Like, do we have to be worried?
Earl, you had you shared a photo of this. Do you want me to put that up?
Oh, sure. If you have that handy.
So this,
see, how beautiful is that?
And there it is.
Ooh, that's lovely. Wow, that came out great.
And everything about it, though, is so stinking heavy. You would think that because the wood surface of the desk is fake wood grain covering, that it would be particle board, not that heavy, and you'd be wrong. It's like
fake
it's,
wood grain over steel.
Everything's a million pounds on this thing.
The colors are so great, though. I love that Altair blue.
Yeah.
Such a good color.
That is absolutely beautiful. For those listening at home, too bad.
And are those dual floppy drives built into the desk?
They go in the 19-inch rack mount cabinet, which is that Altair blue. And it's all rack-mountable equipment.
That's awesome. Was it which TRS-80 model was it that was like it was a desk? Was that the Model 3 or 4?
I think there was a 2. But I don't know if it had to have a desk, but it definitely could have one. I think that was the business one. The chat will probably soon tell us.
I seem to recall that's a really rare one, too, that I've only ever seen photos of.
It was the 2.
Also, mm-hmm. Okay, yeah, and it was also, like, strikingly attractive for being such a beast.
Yep. So back then, all the TRS-80 stuff looked like it would be heavy, but actually weighed, like, nothing.
And this is the opposite.
Yeah.
It looks like wood,
except
but
the
all steel.
Yeah. I wonder if there's something – the color actually sort of evokes lightness. Like, it does sort of seem like it shouldn't weigh very much.
Mm-hmm. It's all
but
part
it feels
of marketing.
Very like it's aged well, like it feels like a high-tech color even today, like it would have felt extremely futuristic at the time, but now it still does feel like future-y looking.
Ooh, and the chat says, remember buying a desk with a slot in it for tractor feed paper.
Oh, yes.
I do remember that. I 100% had that. Oh, yeah. Wow. There's a sense memory coming back.
Yeah, and figuring out where to put the box of tractor feed, that was a serious concern.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And like how loud it was going to be, figuring out how to make it quieter and all that stuff.
Okay, I want a whole podcast about computer desks now that Paul's got another picture up. Yeah, beautiful.
What is this one, Paul?
This, I think, is actually not the System 2 one. This is just
that's not right. The System 2 one.
This is just a Radio Shack desk for your computer.
Ah, okay.
Because
that looks like just a TRS-80 Model 1, right?
Yeah, I think so.
With the expansion chassis under the monitor.
Though that desk has a recessed area. The Model 1 is sitting in it a bit, looks like.
Yeah, I think it's sitting down a little bit.
So cool. It doesn't slide away.
And it looks like maybe there's a recess for the keyboard as well.
Well, the keyboard is the Model 1.
Yeah, my wrists hurt just looking at it.
I do like that printer stand. It looks like it's going fast.
Yeah,
it would be shaking like crazy. Can you imagine putting on the thing?
I'm
sure it tips over immediately.
Actually, this printer, I've kind of wanted one. The Apple, this was at the same time that Apple had the Modem 2B, which was the Novation Cat branded. Apple also sold the same printer. I think this was the printer 2B. Might have been the printer 1B. I'm not sure, but
never heard of it.
Yeah, it's I've seen pictures in the catalog. I've never seen one of these actually with the Apple logo on it available. But I'm sure it is a monster in terms of weight. So I don't think I would want it shipped, and I'm sure it's a terrible printer, but nevertheless I look at it and I think, oh yeah, it's that printer that I don't have.
It's sort of remarkable that we ever tolerated dot matrix. Like, they were so loud and so slow, and the print quality was so bad. I guess it was just such a we needed something that could print so badly that we were willing to put up with all of that, because there was really nothing good about them aside from the fact that you could print, which was in itself amazing.
Yeah.
I always wanted an Apple daisy wheel printer. I never had a daisy wheel, and I still want one.
I was always envious of the Scribe because it was like the only printer that was quiet. It was the Apple's thermal printer that they made.
Yeah.
And it was actually shockingly quiet. Or was it the Silent Type? Maybe that's what I'm thinking of.
I think they were both. I think both of those were thermal.
No, it was the Scribe was the thermal one. The Silent
they
Type
both,
was.
Oh, okay. Yeah, maybe. I think, the one that they initially shipped it with the 2C, or they offered it as an option for the 2C. And yeah, I thought it was really cool how quiet they were, because I had a traditional, like, Epson clone of whatever, that where I literally had to close the door and go downstairs to get away from it because it was so loud.
Uh-huh. Yeah, the Silent Type was the one that was with Apple III. So.
Okay, yeah, the Scribe is the one I'm thinking of then, yeah.
And now I found a picture of the Model 2 with its desk.
Yeah, that's the one.
That's the one. Exactly. That's the one I was thinking of too.
Standard file cabinet drawer in the bottom, because of course you still need paper files. Right. I love it.
Yeah, it would be kind of cool if you could, if the printer was routed in such a way that it could just file itself, open the folder.
Right into the filing cabinet, yeah.
Yeah. I'm sure my office at work is going to go paperless any day now.
Yeah.
still waiting.
Yeah, right on the edge of that.
I actually just bought a printer. I just, I feel dirty. I went like 20 years without owning a printer. I haven't had one since the 90s.
Why'd you have to get a printer?
I had to buy one because the FedEx office near me closed, and like once a year you need to print something because like government forms or whatever. There's still the occasional thing.
And you can't hack into a neighbor's printer, Quinn. Come on. You absolutely know you can print it. Knock on their door. I believe you have something for me, Mr. Smith.
Yeah. Well, the flip side is shocking how good printers have gotten. Like, I got the HP 15MW. It's like the size of, like, I don't know, your forearm. It's tiny, and it prints like 50 pages a minute. Real laser printer, not inkjet scam printer. And it's kind of amazing how good it is. So there's that, I guess.
Oh, as Curtis says, now you can't go paperless because we got to do the archiving to paper. So now you can put all your stuff in the books and it'll last forever. Bringing the show full circle.
We're not printing now, we're archiving.
That's right.
Yeah, that's it.
Much classier.
A much longer word.
Actually, Quinn, do you have any other closing thoughts apart from having bought a printer?
I do not, apart from having bought a printer, which I still, I hate myself for it, but I just, I just couldn't get it. And honestly, now that I own it, it's kind of great. Like, I'm suddenly finding all these uses for it. I'm like, oh, actually owning a printer is kind of handy. Like, I print out recipes and stuff. And like, I don't know, it's dumb, but
Encyclopedia Britannica pages.
Yeah, I'm printing out stickers for mail merging. Like, I do a lot of mailing of stuff for my business. And so it's actually super handy, I begrudgingly must admit. I hate owning a printer.
Yeah, mailing is the thing. That's pretty much the only thing I use an actual printer for.
Yeah, it has saved me a lot of time because I was handwriting, or I was having to go down to FedEx office and use their printers, and so it is nice not to have to do that.
Yeah,
I just order a custom stamp for every page I want to print. I just bam, and then it's so much easier.
That's perfect. Yeah, or just an alphabet of stamps.
Yeah, I'll do all my stuff typeset.
Like serial killer cut it out of magazine. Yeah. Just like,
that tracks.
Here are your stickers and we have your daughter.
Yeah, my grandmother, and I think this is probably, you know, her children, so like my parents' generation, you know, had a little typesetting machine. You know, it was sort of like a play typesetter or something.
Oh, fun.
It had little rubber letters that you slid into racks, and then you put them in, and then you inked it, and then you could print stuff. Actually pretty cool, quite messy, very time consuming, but you know, if it's summer and you're a kid, that's fine.
Fisher Price is my first linotype.
Yeah, exactly. Here's where you put the molten lead.
I do all my stuff with that Letraset that you scratch out.
Oh, Letraset. There was an auction on eBay recently for a big lot of Letrasets.
Oh, that would be tempting.
It went for a lot of money because people love those things. I loved them.
But I loved them.
Apparently they go bad, and so someone spent a lot of money on useless Letrasets the binder chemical that allowed the ink to release from the backing paper, apparently that goes bad, and so they only have a shelf life of about 5 years.
Oh, bummer. Yeah, I have fond memories of using that stuff back in the day. Yeah, totally.
All right, let's see my closing notes. I've been trying to I told people that I was going to write an arcade game for the Apple III, not really knowing anything about doing that. But in mid July, I'm supposedly going to be done with this. So,
excellent.
So I have started, and it's actually,
how does one define arcade and game?
Yeah. Well, right. Exactly. No, I mean, like the story was basically, you know, there really aren't any games for this, but yet it's got some pretty cool, you know, features, and it would be fun to try it out. And so, it has a vertical blanking signal. You know, I can use that. It has many graphics modes. But so actually one of the things that it can do, I discovered this just like recently. I discovered it earlier, but I tried it out just yesterday. But in order to make scrolling text smoother, they added this sort of function where basically you can say, I want you to it's kind of like delay transfer of the screen memory by a line or by up to 7 lines. So essentially what you can do is for no effort, you can say, I want you to start 1 line higher or 2 lines higher or 3 lines higher than you would normally. So if you want to just scroll something, you just basically just, you know, increase this number and it will shift up without you having to move any memory anywhere. And that seems great. You know, if there's any kind of game that you want to do scrolling, and you've only got, you know, like a 1.8 megahertz, you know, processor to work with, then this is excellent. So I tried this out. I've written one program in assembly on the Apple III, and I tried to test out this shifting. And when I did it, the text started shifting horizontally. I have no idea why. And I didn't think that was possible. I don't know if it's a MAME bug or
that could be more useful.
It would be more useful, actually. But so I have yet to actually plug this into my actual Apple III and see if it's, you know, MAME misinterpreting something or if that actually is possible. Because that would open up a lot of things that would not require dividing by 7. So
that's really cool. I'm actually glad you're doing that because I have always wanted to do that because the Apple III is so underappreciated in terms of the graphics capabilities that it has, the modes and stuff. And I didn't know until you said that it has, those are called scroll registers. Mm-hmm. And that's how game consoles, for example, like the Nintendo, that's how they do scrolling. It's the same deal. They have a register where you can offset by up to the width of the standard tile, mm-hmm, -1, so that you can smoothly scroll between tiles, and then you jump all your tiles over, smoothly scroll and continue. Yeah. So, and I think the Amiga has scroll registers as well, if I'm not mistaken. So, but yeah, that's awesome. I can't wait to see what you do.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, I'm also looking forward to that. I have much bigger ideas than will probably wind up being realized, but we will see. But yeah, I mean, the fact that these computers don't let you just say, like, start the graphics memory here is difficult. So this is at least one step of help. So
cool.
That's neat.
All right. I guess that's it. I guess we made it. And Quinn did not blue screen.
I did not. Yeah.
Yet.
We may have jinxed it here, but so far, maybe I'll stop recording now while the file's still intact.
Yeah, exactly.
As far as we know, Earl did, though.
Yeah. It's funny, you know, with Earl's camera off, it's sort of like...
It's a lot better, isn't it?
Well, it does seem like, it doesn't encourage you to talk, I guess, or something. So Earl was here the whole time.
No shirt, no camera. It's going to be a rule going forward. I'm sorry.
I just feel like I'm on the Wonder Years. I have a thought, and then this disembodied voice like crystallizes that thought. It's very convenient.
Anyway, yeah. Oh, and so I guess the next episode probably will really be 257. We're not going to start over again. That would just confuse all the podcatchers. But I think we are not going all 16-bit.
That probably not.
We agree on that.
Yeah. Everything gets complicated then.
Yeah. Okay. So anyway, that is it for this show. You can find the show notes for this and all the RCR shows at rcrpodcast.com. You can discuss the show in the forum at vcfed.org/forum/forum.php. I've left a picture of the person in plaid pants at the TRS-80 Model 2 computer desk to minimize the size of the people dancing.
That's cheap.
Those pants are amazing.
I got those on now.
You can follow RCR on Twitter at RCR Podcast. You can join our Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/RCR Podcast. You can send feedback to feedback@rcrpodcast.com, and that will allow us to actually have something to talk about. We are a member of the Throwback Network at throwbackreviews.com. And please write a review on iTunes if you wish. And until next time,
Retro-Compute!
Myself back to